This is the Cybersecurity Amplified and Intensified Podcast.
Hi, dude. What's going on?
Another day, another week of, you know, ransomware and security issues and just the world that makes me want to turn into old Yoda every day.
Speaking of ransomware, what's your take on some of these newer groups or older groups pretending to be new, claiming to be DarkSid and have affiliations with Reval?
It's really interesting. The fact that people are actually using the postal system to send a letter to potentially affected or non-infected people and entities saying, hey, we got your information, blah, 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 you know, pay us or we'll go leak it all over the dark web. It's definitely not normal for anybody, really. I mean, that's really uncharted territory. You know, I was thinking about it over the weekend. I don't know of any other ransomware group or any other hacking group, period, that would actually use the postal system for that. I mean, that's a whole new level of bold.
I think it boils down to the fact that they are evolving faster than the defense can. And the second part of using traditional mail, I saw that they are sending out, or ransomware groups are sending out USB keys as well as FIDO keys or FIDO type keys like Yubico keys to potential victims to try to get into the authentication cycle. Have you seen any of that?
Yeah, so they are, you know, sending out, I think it was Lockheed or one of the hardware tokens, but they would send out a modified hardware token with a USB store, a soldered on USB storage that would pretty much phone home. So when you entered your recovery keys, it would phone home, send that. So that way the hackers could, you know, essentially steal your cryptocurrency that you may have. And that's based off of, you know, actual information that's been publicized from breaches. So the whole postal system and everything, a lot of these folks really want to be anonymous in every sense of the facet. You know, so everything's being done on Tor, everything's being done on the quote unquote dark web. And, you know, there's no tracing of it, but now you have people that are invoking the postal service and potentially probably committing a federal crime. So, you know, while they try to stay out of the FBI's grasp as much as possible by being anonymous, that it's almost like they're giving them the proverbial middle finger, because that is extortion through the federal system.
But it's already extortion through the federal system just by using the internet, when you really think about it, because that's wire fraud. It's wire fraud. Whereas if you use the postal service, it's mail fraud. Two statutes.
I don't know
wire fraud is more so today's version of mail fraud.
But how is that wire fraud when you actually get somebody to knowingly send you money? You know, that's more of a scam or a con job versus a wire fraud, because those were, you know, I hacked into your system and transferred out of your account.
Wire just means a cable, a line that got in. I mean, that's the loose definition of it. So either way, they are in the FBI's area of operation or whichever federal agency, law enforcement agency here. But what I think is really brazen, and I think you're right, it is almost a middle finger saying, hey, we are inside the wire, or we are using your resources inside the wire, meaning inside the continental U.S. Mm-hmm. to do things.
Yeah. So it's real interesting that the tactics that some people will take, you know, the quote unquote easy route than actually, you know, doing something for a living. So yeah, it really goes back to when, you know, panhandling, and it depends on where you are in the world or the country, you know, panhandling may or may not be legal. It's illegal where I live. But you know, there's been all those documentaries where people just make gobs of freaking money panhandling where they don't have to work a job. You know, it's crazy. So I think it's kind of goes along that. It's just, you know, the whole email scams, hey, I seen you, you know, pleasuring yourself. And I'm like, cool, send me the picture of the Snickers bar that I was eating. you know, you've made the joke before. Cool, put it up on Pornhub, because then we can make a bunch of money off of that.
Hey man, if you don't show your face, I think you get like 15 grand. If you show your face, it's 25. Knock yourself out. It's worth more than the ransom that they're trying to get. But the other thing is, you know, something you said here, it's like panhandling begging. It's not a real job. I think that's the that's a common misconception. This is a real job for some of these people. Mm-hmm. You know, they have affiliates. They have horizontally and vertically integrated systems and people that come and attack. And one of my concerns is, I think we're in one of those lulls all over again. You know, we talk about it all the time. They go dark for a week or two, and it's a tidal wave of attacks. And with the seeding of all these USB keys, I have a feeling it's just getting started.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about before the changing of tactics. You know, are these the folks that are openly hacking into networks and changing their tactic just to do something different? You know, the AKA we're pivoting to a new methodology, or is it just some meathead somewhere in a basement trying to freaking, you know, capitalize on any of that? I don't know. It's the one thing that was interesting, especially about the dark side doppelgangers, is they sent out a single Bitcoin address to everybody. And thankfully, nobody bought in. Nobody, at least the last time I checked on Saturday, nobody has made any transactions to that wallet. So thankfully, people are being a little bit smart about some of this stuff. But I'm curious if the FBI is really getting involved by the sheer number of things that were mailed. I'm not sure if it has to meet a threshold.
Well, what about, you know, them putting out a single Bitcoin address makes me think of one thing. The FBI recouping some of that Colonial ransom. Is this the groups putting that address out to see what type of probes and tactics are going to be used against it so they can map a response from the FBI or whomever?
That is an interesting thought that I have not entertained. Yeah, I mean, the money is supposed to be decentralized, right? So how can they really seize a Bitcoin wallet address? Yeah, I mean, I know they had the dark side, you know, where they recover it, but there's speculation where somebody, either the CIA or NSA or whatever, potentially hacked one of the end users of the group and was able to steal that hardware token key.
From warrants that or court paperwork that's been released or unsealed, it seems like someone in the alphabet soup got access to the server that stored the keys for that wallet. So that was a human failure on the part of the ransomware guys that, again, the alphabet soup was able to capitalize on and recoup some of that money.
I wonder now, if it was a Windows Server 2003 they were using.
No, that's the New York Law Center. And, you know, all of our colleagues they love this MFA bandwagon. Let's use MFA. MFA will protect you. MFA will do everything. But no one seems to be talking about the fact that the New York Law Division or Center, whatever they call themselves, were running on Server 2003. End of life, end of support, 2015. So that's a system that hasn't had a security update in 6 years. And I'm willing to bet they're not even on the most up-to-date version of Server 2003, because that would make too much sense, right?
Yeah, I mean, you and I were talking about this, and I had to double-check just to make sure I was correct, but you can't put MFA on 2003.
Yes, you can. All of our colleagues said it would save them.
Oh, okay.
Pizza Tech International stamped and approved the MFA for Server 2003 when MFA probably wasn't even a thing then.
All right, I'm just a loser. Whip out the stuff from when I was a kid. Loser. But anyway, but yeah, I mean, you can't even tie it to Azure so you can do a hybrid and leverage the Microsoft, you know, authentication. It's, you know, I wonder. So there's just so many things that go through my head. Like, how the hell did they even get to that server? Was it exposed to the web, you know, or do they have an SSH server that was potentially...
VPN seems to be the access vector. A user's compromised credentials were obtained and they got to the box or the network via the VPN. And New York's version of Cyber Command saw something amiss and started shutting things down.
So they got past VPN, got to the box.
They were on the network.
Yeah, before they even knew?
they were on the network, and by all accounts in the public media, they were corralling information or data to be exfiltrated, and then the agencies expected the system to have been cryptoed. So once they saw that data being put into a centralized location, feasibly on their network, that's when they shut everything down.
That's it. I mean, I guess it's good that they at least caught it before it got too bad. But that's still a major failure. You know, we talk about this all the time, especially when you're going, we're having the discussions about CMMC and, you know, NIST 800-171. You know, this is a failure of logging at a firewall level. You know,
well, let's talk about CGIS. You know, that CGIS and HIPAA are my hard-ons in terms of compliance because they are failures. They don't actually do anything. How are you CGIS compliant if you're running server 2003 without MFA? Let's just say, for the sake of argument, you could actually put MFA on that bad boy. Now, who signed off and said they acknowledge and accept that risk? Secondly, how much money did they spend maintaining the server 2003 architecture? And wouldn't that have been better spent and probably cheaper or the same price as updating along the way?
I would imagine it cheaper in the long run, you know, especially when you have an incident like this, because the amount of man hours that are being generated just to comb through logs to make sure there was no data exfiltration and, you know, that everything is of the status quo has got to be extensive, right? So I can't even imagine. I mean, is it possible that maybe that was just one of the domain controllers still in the network?
You know, but why is it even still there? By all accounts, they say the system is run on Microsoft software from 2003 that was end of life in 2015. Now, the other interesting part of this is New York has what they call the SHIELD Act, and they define a breach as unauthorized access. Mm-hmm. What happens to the law department now when they failed their own system?
And did they pay the ransomware? Because
there was no ransomware. Nothing was triggered. They caught it while the data was being, I don't want to say manipulated, but while the data was being collated and put into a form where it would probably have been exfiltrated. Now, you know me, I'm a skeptic here. I think once they get in, they start pulling data out. I don't see any utility in corralling that data and then doing one massive data dump. It's far easier to hide that in everyday traffic, as we saw with SolarWinds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as long as you got time, because, you know, there's still the two ransomware type of mentalities: either get in, spread laterally as quick as possible, drop your payload and boogie, or, you know, it's, you know, they have several weeks to slowly exfiltrate their data, not to set off alarms, and then drop their payload. You know, the SolarWinds was, you know, we keep hearing where they keep pushing back the timeline of where they actually got into the network. I think the last one was the middle of last year now, maybe even.
No, I know the timeline goes back to, I think, the middle of 19.
So
early 19. Listen, by the time, if there's ever a day where the SolarWinds saga has been identified, we're probably going back to, I would say, 15 or 16, realistically, because you have to put human capital in place to do a lot of these things. With the, I don't think you could do all that over the wire.
Yeah. I mean, so when we talk about the SolarWinds, and everybody has been so quick, and even to this day, to say Russia was behind it, I still haven't seen anybody really come out and say it was Russia. Well, I mean, except for Biden, you know, and
I think Russia is the perfect scapegoat. Now, I'm not saying they didn't do it, but they are the most obvious choice, because there has been a lot of speculation that these groups operate out of Russia. But as we saw with SolarWinds, you know, they were going to US-based IPs. They were going to Azure and AWS infrastructure. It wasn't going back to Moscow, St. Petersburg, or any of the other cities over there. Mm-hmm. And in March of this year, I want to say there was a report that 10 other groups were inside of SolarWinds, not just what do they call them? Nobelium?
Mm.
The Nobelium group was the same group from SolarWinds. But there were a couple different APTs in there.
It's just crazy, you know, that a simple payload, and then they just pretty much, you know, feather out the access to the different things. So, you know, when you're in that long, you're like, what could go wrong, right? I mean, freaking, you know, drink all the booze and hack all the things, right? So,
well, the beautiful thing, and I hate to use that word, for SolarWinds is the amount of patience that was demonstrated. Mm-hmm. They knew how to get around sandboxing to ping live IPs that were not redirected to internal IPs of a sandbox. They knew to wait 2 weeks before launching.
I was getting ready to say that.
You know, these guys compromised the code signing. Like, they went straight to the root of what Orion is or was. And I don't think we're ever going to know the real impact, whether it's classified or whether the alphabet soup ever even figures it out.
And to best of my understanding, SolarWinds is still allowed in all DoD infrastructures as long as it's an air gap situation, which takes out the purpose of SolarWinds Orion.
You know, the problem is, once, you know, in the beginning, they said, take it off the internet, don't let it be accessible. But if something has been that compromised for the entire time, it's created other jump points into other boxes. I told you, I know of a vendor in DoD, alphabet soup, civilian government, everything, as well as private companies and international governments and companies. And they have been popped, and their products are now jump points into anywhere they're plugged in with an IP. And this is all because of how procurement works. Mm-hmm. Here's a question for you. Your thing is instant response. How many times have you gone into a situation that started off because of a legacy system that got hit?
A lot. I mean, we're still getting, even to this day, Exchange 2003 boxes of OWA that was compromised.
But that's okay, because the FBI will patch those for you. If it's anything Exchange, they got you. No. Especially if you're in Texas.
Exactly. But it's, you know, we see it all the time. And especially in the manufacturing industry and services industry, there's a lot of, you know, custom-built apps that are created for these industries. And a lot of these legacy manufacturing operational machinery that is used for that. And it's really crazy that happens. That I would have never thought, until I got into IR and really started digging into some of these things, that this world would be there. You know, you would figure in today's age, there would be people creating software to do this stuff, but there's not.
You can't create software for people who are too damn cheap to spend any money, right? And I don't care what anyone says about VLANing a Windows XP machine. There's always access. There's no such thing as a real air gap. And if you're running a legacy system, I created my own hashtag. Legacy system. Legacy means you're too damn cheap.
Well, I mean, I want to push back on that a little bit, because I know of some systems that, or some networks, they're not too cheap to pay for the likes of me, but to actually rehaul their entire infrastructure and the machines that run that business will put them out of business when it comes to actually competing with third world labor markets. And I think that may be part of the problem we talked about before.
But you know, here's my pushback on that. They come to you because they have a direct need. They fucked up, they got popped, and now they need Eric and Barricade to save their ass. And they typically have to pay that ransom because the company they had doing their backups didn't do backups, or didn't do effective backups, right? But how many of these companies have a really well-built out IT department? Probably none.
None.
How many of those have if they don't have a well-built out IT department, what's their security department like?
They don't have one.
What's their CISO like, other than the guy who got the title because they needed it for a checkbox?
I mean, most of these companies don't even have, or are big enough to really consider having a CISO, you know, and that's really where, as much as I hate to use the term, but the virtual CISO, you know, really comes into play with some of these folks. But it's, I don't know, man, it's, you really find these companies that have, you know, one guy, just like we see with the quote-unquote pizza techs, that know a pretty good bit about IT, and they become that person. And then they hire one or two of their friends that knows a little bit like about IT that they sat around, you know, drinking a couple of beers and smoking some meat. You know,
hey man, one of the best IR guys I know smokes meat on the weekends. So. And by meat, I'm talking in a Traeger grill. Get your minds out of the gutter, people.
Yes. I love that Traeger grill. Holy moly.
But is it connected to the internet?
No, I do have the capability, but no.
Good man.
I want to though, just so I can monitor the temperature. But I'm like,
I guarantee you there's some legacy system built into that bad boy.
Of course it comes from China.
Well, then it's safe. They would never put secret chips in anything. That would never happen.
Super micro. Oh, boy.
Going back to incident response here. When you go in and it's a legacy system, what's the first thing that you do?
Those legacy systems, we got to figure out exactly what it does. You know, I mean, and then we got to figure out, you know, once we isolate it and contain, make sure that that legacy system is actually stable and we can be able to use it. You know, we do... You know, we have to put in its own VLAN and, you know, put in ports that can only cross over to certain to that machine box for whatever reason. Then we try to figure out, is there a way that we can actually replace that legacy box, that legacy software?
Now, you're talking about VLANs here. And I know a lot of these companies won't spend for the good Cisco, the good Palo Alto, like the good stuff, right? A lot of these guys are slinging UniFi, MikroTix. Dumb switches and the worst of the worst. And you and I had this discussion once, I think, and your preference is to actually put these legacy systems on a physically separate LAN because of how poorly constructed and secured they were from the beginning. Mm-hmm. What's the response like from your clients when you tell them, hey, you guys just got popped. It's probably the legacy system. Let's invest $500 on a brand new switch to physically separate this. What's that conversation like?
They're normally pretty open to it. I mean, here's the real crutch of this situation that we always find ourselves in. You know, we talked about this numerous times. Is, you know, we come in as an incident response, you know, and we'll talk to the IT folks or whatever. And it's always, oh, we didn't have the budget. We didn't have the budget. We didn't have the budget. And then as soon as they get popped, their wallets open up for at least 6, 8, 12 months where they're willing to put in some stuff, but then it goes back to the way it was before and, you know, budget cuts and everything like that. And we always have to have that round robin. It's like, you remember a year ago, you remember 2 years ago, how much you were down, how much it cost you. You're subjecting yourself to this.
Where does that money come from? Because the insurance company likes to reimburse. They don't like to give you an open purse string.
Well, let's talk about insurance for a minute. A lot of companies that we deal with, they have a cybersecurity policy, but
not for long.
It doesn't work very well. You know, it's much like your home insurance policy. You know, it doesn't cover flood. It doesn't cover, you know, tornado, hurricane, you know, wherever you are, you know, whether you get earthquake insurance or whatever.
I'm like, in an undisclosed location from hackers. Yeah.
A lot of these insurance companies will not pay a ransomware fee. A lot of these insurance companies will only pay for our initial diagnostics of how did this thing happen? You know, and companies got to be careful. This is the one thing, as soon as I hear they have a cybersecurity policy, literally all breaks of work stop. It's like, all right, we need a copy of this policy because we got to go through and see, you know, who is on your panel and are we able to work this thing?
What, you don't like working for free in the hopes of one day maybe somehow getting paid?
No, I believe in a capitalist system. You know, my kids don't eat and drink off of hopes and dreams.
Is there a balancing point for the insurance company of paying that ransom versus paying for the remediation? Or do they just pick one way and go that way all the time? And to put this into perspective, let's say, and I'm using specifically low numbers here because I don't want to scare people away. Let's say a ransom is $1,000 and the remediation or your services would be $1,500. Would the insurance company rather pay you that $1,500 or would they rather pay the ransom of $1,000? And let's be honest, the rent, you know, both costs are significantly higher in real life.
Exactly. nine times out of 10, they're not going to pay the ransom because it's not in their policy. And a lot of insurance companies will deem that as an act of terror against a business. And they don't have, you know, that put into their policy. That a lot of companies will think, oh, well, this goes under my general liability or my errors and omissions because, you know, we mistakenly omitted putting in a certain security. And I've had customers actually fight that tooth and nail with customer or with their insurance companies about that. And, you know, they end up losing it, but it kind of is what it is. They don't have the policy. So they need to really spend some time beforehand of knowing exactly what their policy covers and what it doesn't cover. And go through, you know, we talk about this all the time. Just doing an incident response or a disaster recovery. And I want to take that one further. It's like, what happens if A happens? What happens if B happens? And put ransomware as part of C, D, E, whatever that scenario is. You know, what happens if you get hit with ransomware? You know, it's like I say to a lot of my customers, like, okay, I'm going to pull up a box truck out front. I'm going to come in, unplug everything, throw it into the box truck, lock it up, and you can't get it until you pay me money. That's essentially what you got.
Now, when you're doing these IRs and you're doing it through insurance, is it getting to the point where they're practically giving you a playbook of what you should be doing? Otherwise, it's not going to be covered.
Some policies, yes. Some of them, we literally have to, you know, go through hoops and, you know, really put together our invoicing in a certain way. Like we've got one right now where they would pay for the remediation, but they won't pay for the negotiation. They won't pay for the Bitcoin. They won't pay my services to decrypt, but the actual rebuilding of the network, putting in the new domain, putting in the new everything, they'll pay for that.
Which is like rebuilding a house from a fire, right?
Exactly.
But who pays for the non-covered items?
The client does, the entity, business entity.
And that goes back to my question. Where do they all of a sudden get this seemingly unlimited pocketbook from?
I don't know. I mean, I'm suspecting either they have cash on hand or they're accessing a line of credit, you know, because they always act like they're cash poor. But when it comes time to pay the ransomware, they end up finding it pretty freaking quick.
Have you ever done any kind of study or comparison on what it would cost them to have been secured effectively or enough to a certain level, as opposed to having to go through and pay for this incident? Because you have your fees, you have what the insurance will cover, and then you have the ripple effect after the incident and the insurance company has dealt with that specific incident. You have increased premiums, loss of coverage, you have your loss of business. What's the balance point of doing a good job all the time versus having to go and remediate? Not for you, but for these clients.
That really is a case-by-case scenario, unfortunately. These businesses are, it depends on how impacted they are. You know, if they had a really good backup and they got hit with ransomware and they got back up and running in 48 hours, they're like, yeah, whatever. Right. So
how often is that the case? A good backup getting them up and running in, let's give them 4 days. Let's give them 3 days.
About 2% of the time.
Okay. So there is a chance.
There is a chance. It's very minimal, but there is a chance. You know, there's, I guess if they are a, I don't want to use the term lightly, but a public facing company. So, you know, take for instance, a medical practice, you know, you are interacting with the public in a very highly capacity or in a very high efficiency way, to inappropriately use words there. A high frequency way. There we go. High frequency way. Then you're going to have a level of impact that's a lot greater than a used car salesman type of facility, right? So they can just easily pass it off. Oh, our systems are down for a couple of days. They do things by phone and by paper, they would get by, you know, and be able to recover somewhat from that. But a medical practice, you know, when you can't pull up your medical records to do your consults post-surgery or post-incident, or, you know, you're going to a specialist and they need to fax over the medical records or email them to some god-awful multi-tenant Gmail account, they can't do it because of a ransomware. So it really depends on the impact.
Technically, they can, because there's a good chance all that data is already on the darknet.
Mm.
So they can get their own patient data as a service out there.
We actually had one not so long ago that wanted to wait until the information was posted on the dark web and me download it all and give it back to them. I'm like, no, I'm not doing that.
How many times have you seen that in the medical field, though?
Where they wanted me to just download the compromised data?
No, really this laissez-faire attitude of not giving a shit about security and thinking it's okay for their patients' data to be in the public. I mean, you know, we're talking social security number. We're talking health data, biometric data. And these are all things that enemies of our country will use to profile people.
Mm-hmm.
You can, you know, you're a vet. You've gone, I'm assuming, you know, you've had interactions with the VA. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming you've also had interactions with private doctors that are not a part of the VA system. And the argument could be made that your private doctor is probably going to be targeted more, mm-hmm. because there are going to be service members who go there for scheduling purposes, or maybe, you know, they're a top physician in their field. And now this is OSINT data.
Yeah. And I mean, just to be clear, most...
Well, not OSINT, but, you know.
Yeah, HIPAA. So most private medical facilities, you know, I would say 5 practitioners and under really don't care. You know, it's really the whole, we don't care about HIPAA for the most part. It's a...
Well, did you know that Gmail gives them free email to service to use?
Yeah. With no real protections. They don't care. You know, I think the ransomware incidents are much like the HIPAA incidents. They see it as a minor blip in the grand scheme of the overall practice.
Yeah. What happens when these guys come around for a second bite of the apple? And this was something you and I discussed with one of our previous guests maybe about a month ago, asking if their SOC service has been seeing this second come around. And now, at least the news articles we are exposed to are talking about companies getting hit 2-3 times. Look at Carnival Cruises that you posted a couple of days ago.
Yep.
They had 4 data breaches in the last year and a half, 2 major.
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing there in terms of incident response? Are you seeing the second bite at the apple?
I'm seeing a lot of it. And I've actually got, you know, friends that go routinely on cruises. And, you know, I reached out to them over the weekend. I'm like, so do you use Carnival? They're like, yeah. So I talked to them about this. And I think this really goes to the heart of it. They don't care, because all of their, you know, their stuff is backed up by the bank. So if, you know, their credit cards got stolen, you know, I know my bank and most of the banks I've ever dealt with, at least recently, you can walk in and get a new card, you know, same day. You file a paper and you can get your funds back within a day.
You self-attest.
Yes. You know, and it's really weird that, so, I mean, if for a medical practice to be compromised, I don't think most people will care, because you and I talked about this before, and I think it was you, or maybe about one of my friends that I was talking to over the weekend. They're like, oh, well, you know, Equifax hauls all of our data, so why should we care about CVS, and why should we care about Carnival and everything? I'm like, look, you need to take this from a 30,000-foot view. It's like, okay, what if one hacking group has all of Equifax data? Now they're able to get their hands on Carnival. They're able to get their hands on CVS and all these other ones, and they start correlating this data to fill in any pieces that they may be missing or confirm pieces that they already have.
You know, I look at it as they're building targeting packages, mm-hmm. on everyone. And they may not want to target you, but there will be a targeting package on you if they really start cross-referencing all this data. Now, in terms of that second bite at the apple, how are the insurance companies handling the IR there? Because I'm assuming they're going to say something along the lines of, hey, we paid for this not to happen again in the remediation. What gives?
Exactly. We had a couple of them where they came back to us about 8 months later, and they got put again. And their insurance company is like, well, what did you do differently this time around to prevent it? Then they're like hemming and hauling, and they didn't take any of the recommendations that we had.
How many times did they blame you? Let me qualify the statement. How many times do they take the money from the insurance company? They pay you for some form of service to remediate, manage, you know, whatever we want to call it. Insurance stops paying. Maybe they'll carry you for an extra month. But you and I both know once they have to start paying, they cut that bill as much as they can. How many times have they blamed you? And how many times has the insurance company believed them or needed something from you to prove that you weren't derelict in what you were doing?
Whether the customer blames me or not, the insurance company always wants information from me. Even if we are the current provider of security services or not, they always want to know what our recommendations were. Were those recommendations put in place at the time of termination? And who was responsible for maintaining those recommendations going forward? And we've had two former clients that got popped again that tried to blame me for not putting together or putting in place the recommendations that we did. It's like, we recommended it. You said you had your own internal IT that would handle it. We just need to make recommendations. Here's the email communication. I don't know what else
you want me to do. Did you notify internal IT that Webroot does not count as protection? It's like drilling a hole into a condom and then trying to use it.
Mm, yeah. But they have DNS filtering now.
Yeah, so do the ransomware groups. They're far more sophisticated than anything we have going on, and they're far more coordinated. You don't do what these guys are doing by being an idiot. Mm-mm. It's well coordinated, and there's a financial component, but there's also a component of, I keep saying this, breaking the hearts and minds of the American people.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
you keep chiseling away at something, it's going to give.
Yeah. And something's got to give, right? I mean, we've seen some articles that I haven't really discussed today, but, you know, where ransomware is expected to be even at all time high to this year compared to last year. You know, I can safely say that the first 6 months of this year of our business and what we've done has already exceeded what we did last year, you know, and it's just crazy.
Let's qualify this. Is it because you're building a better reputation in the industry, or is it really down to more incidents? Is it both?
So I think it's a little bit of both, at least for me and, you know, the company Barricade, right? So, you know, we're building better relationships with other IR firms, you know, because we are a smaller company. So we're not as big as Coveware, Kroll, you know, some of these other ones, just to drop names. But
one thing that I really wish, and correct me if I'm wrong here, you're in the IR space. You came from the managed services. Mm-hmm. You know, we probably started serving pizzas at one time, then we got into managed services, and now you're into the IR. And for those of you listening, IR is incident response. It seems to be more of a collaborative effort amongst your peers. Mm-hmm. And there doesn't seem to be any tearing down of each other as there is in typical IT services, where one provider thinks they're better than the other and, you know, they mouth off about them.
No, and I mean, the IR space, the penetration space, you know, when I play, because I play in both of the sides of the fence, right? And, you know, we all have, unless you're, again, name drop, unless you're Kroll and you're Coveware or whatever, and you're just this big, massive company, a lot of us, even myself, even to today, even when I was doing pen testing over the weekend, we all have imposter syndrome. Like, we're not supposed to be in this field. What are we doing? Even though we do really great work and, you know, our reputation is growing by doing that, but, you know, we all feel the same thing. And thankfully, those who get into IR and start getting to, you know, start building a little bit of a name for themselves, we'll build either a really good name or a really bad name really quick. You know, I mean, there's an expose that, you know, we'll have to talk about one time around Monster Cloud, where there was like one or two other ones that was put out by Tech Republica, that those guys are supposed to be the leading data forensics folks that will recover files. Guess what? All they're doing is negotiating and saying, hey, hackers, how much do you want for this key? And then they give the key to the rent to the clients and charge a premium for it, you know,
which is not a bad model. I mean, you're getting the data back. You're feasibly going around OFAC, which probably is not a good idea. Everyone's got some kind of racket that they're going to run, but the guys who are doing that, what are they doing to harden the systems? Because I know you, even if you are contracted to negotiate a ransom, I don't think you're the type of person that would go into an engagement that doesn't deal with hardening the systems, at least while you're in there, so that it doesn't happen again. I'm not saying it won't happen again, but I know you well enough to know you're not going to leave them bare.
Nope. Now, we have had a couple of recent engagements where we are only the negotiation and processing of currency over to the hackers, but we do strongly try to get into the hardening, into the recommendations and, you know, the forensic side of things as much as possible.
What's the barrier to entry for the hardening side? Because a company just gets popped. I know, and I've come across companies who got popped and they still refuse to spend money. How do you deal with that when you're going into a remediation where, okay, you may not be contracted for it, but there's a chance someone else might be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shared workload. But there are going to be companies that say, we just want our data back. We don't care if it happens again. How do you deal with that?
We just have to roll with the punches, you know. And it really depends on how arrogant, honestly, that the prospect is. You know, if they are just blatantly, we give zero Fs about anything, I'll turn the work away.
So you don't work with the medical field. Got it.
We can't, you know, that really comes back, and I've talked about it before, I don't think on here, but at least privately, it's just like giving a drunk a drink. All you're doing is enabling. You're granted, it's great for my bottom line. I made a little bit of extra money by doing a negotiation, but I didn't help a freaking damn person. I just enabled them to be bad going forward. So what good am I serving when I do that?
Where do you see, and this may be too early to tell, where do you see this whole industry of ransomware remediation protection going if and when the insurance companies stop paying the ransom? Because I saw something over the weekend where, and I didn't dig too much into this, maybe you did, someone spoke about ransoms being tax deductible now.
I did hear about that. I won't speak on that, you know, at least the tax deductible side, you know, I guess I will talk about it. Here we go. you know, it is a taxable event, you know, it is a deduction that, you know, that you had to make out. So should it be a tax deduction? Yes and no. You know, I think there should be a barrier to responsibility on that one, maybe. So, you know, if you want to claim a tax deduction on a ransomware, being able to show that by no fault of your own, or at least no malintent on your own anyway.
But is that true? In every ransomware incident remediation you've gone into, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I will, so you don't have to say it. It's because someone willfully neglected to take care of their security, so they got popped.
Yeah, and is it on the IT person? Or the owner.
I would say it's the C-suite. And in the SMB space, it's the owner. It's whatever their leadership is. They don't want to spend money because everyone thinks having an employee that does IT means you have an IT department. And as we're learning, IT goes so much further than computers. Now, we're talking about cybersecurity. We're talking about risk management, risk mitigation.
Mm-hmm.
There's no compliance really in the SMB space. If you're medical, yeah, you're dealing with HIPAA, but who gives a shit? Nobody does. FINRA seems to be the only one with any teeth out there. Sarbanes-Oxley.
Mm-hmm. Well, because they have the SEC, or SEC, that's, you know, really coming down on them. That's that's something that's been known to have massive teeth, you know.
Because there's a financial penalty, right? It's with HIPAA, you get a fine, you appeal it, and HHS forgets about it, moves on to the next idiot. Mm-hmm. And it's one big circle jerk. So,
I mean, when you start talking about some of this stuff, it's like, okay, you got a small, since we're talking about medical, just to keep it on medical, you got a small couple practitioner office, and they say, okay, you know, we need, you know, Johnny Sue to be able to do medical billing from home. You know, how can we easily open this up? And the IT guy is like, oh, well, we just do this. We'll change
3389.
But they
on the internet.
They want to be really secure, so they'll change it from 3389 to 5487, and you know, they'll change it on the internal IP or the internal device as well, so it matches. Because that's, you know, because we're not on 3389.
They're too smart. No one's going to know.
Exactly. So maybe the business owner thought they were doing all right because their IT guy said, oh, we can do it this way. You know, the question always has to be, but how secure is this process? What are the risks by invoking this process?
How long before insurance companies and business owners start going after IT companies for their mistakes, their inadequacies, their incompetence, their whatever?
I think that goes back to gross negligence. You know, we talked about this, and you know, legally I can't talk about the company or anything like that, but we have a case that's probably wrapping up today or tomorrow, that literally their entire network, all computers, workstations, servers, everything was running KMS Pico, which is a known software to bypass the Microsoft licensing.
And but it's free. It's okay.
Yeah. And I mean, they're known to have back doors in them, right? And, you know, I've seen it where we'll have Sumo Logic or we'll have Rita put installed, and we can see it beaconing back, you know, and opening up doors. You know, I mean, it will, especially if you have a residential consumer grade router, it will open UPnP and allow people to come in.
But that's okay. It's the least you can do for getting free software. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's really stupid.
But I really think we're getting to the point where you're going to see insurance companies subrogating claims against IT providers for doing a piss poor job. And where I think that's really going to come down to bear is when some companies are getting that second round of ransomware, and the IR guys or the guys who are dealing with the remediation are promising one thing and they're not actually doing it. Like, take you for instance. There's a vendor. We'll leave them nameless for now. I've been raving about them for the last year. You're coming on board with them right now. How many people in our sphere won't deal with this company because they don't want to make that investment? But that investment's going to pay dividends for your clients.
It goes back to the old mentality that I always keep saying. Companies are going to do things as cheap and as long as possible until they're forced otherwise. You know,
and how do you force them?
They got to get breached. There's got to be...
Everyone's getting breached. No one cares.
Until you feel a pain point, until you feel it in your ass that you've got a dog biting and nibbling from your backside.
I figured it out. I cracked the code. Fuck it. We can all go home. I know how to stop ransomware.
Biden?
Any money better. Any money that is spent on remediation, ransomware, or anything like that should not be tax deductible.
Aren't business expenses still tax deductible, though?
They should carve it out because you can do whatever the fuck you want. If you're a politician, you can make a rule or law, whatever you want to call it. But seriously, if you make IR or you make the ransomware, if you take away its ability to be tax deductible, a lot of companies will not pay that ransom. They would rather spend the money on the security, which is tax deductible.
Yep.
Or give the money you spend, because, you know, fraud will never happen, on cybersecurity a multiplier. You spend a dollar, you can claim a $1.50 deduction.
Yeah, I mean, We've seen it before. I mean, think about the old days when we were growing up. Because, I mean, you're about the same age as I am, if I remember right. Yeah, but at least down here, we always had those yearly inspection vehicles that you could have for your car, going through the emissions tests and stuff like that.
Oh, you mean when you go to the DMV, somebody would pay somebody $20 for the sticker? Yeah, I know that.
Yeah. So, I mean, that will be the kind of same thing where, some consultants that, are out there would probably just funnel in the cryptocurrency payment in through the consulting. So that way it's tax deductible.
No, I think what you got to do is you have to get invoices from your vendors, line iteming everything. Mm-hmm. Here's what I've been paying for AV for this time frame to this time frame, my SOC, my this, whatever the bells and whistles are. You allow those to be, they are tax deductible, but maybe you give them a multiplier.
Maybe.
Say multiply by 1.25. You spend a dollar, you can claim a $1.25 deduction or $1.50. But if you have to go through an incident, none of that money can be deductible, tax deductible.
Or repaid it within the first 5 years.
What do you mean repaid?
So if you go through, if you claim you're doing the methods and you're just submitting whatever BS invoices or whatever, and you get popped within the first 5 years, you have to repay it all.
I think if you get popped whenever.
Well, I don't want to put whatever because, I mean, just as well as I do, these things change all the time, right? So, the tactics and stuff like that could be new stuff that your current stack wasn't protecting you against.
But there's the effort. And there's the fact that you actually invested into your systems.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Right. I'm talking more about the guy that says, we're taking security, make itself at the station in this case. The one time that hot steaming pile of shit might actually make sense. You're saying you're spending all this money. You're doing this, you're doing that, you're checking your boxes, you're changing your maxi pad. You get popped. Someone comes in and audits you to make sure you actually spent your money for what you got your deductions on and your multiplier. And if you don't, you get taxed 5 times what you say you spent.
Welcome to CMMC. Nice.
I don't think CMMC is going to change shit, but I like it. I just don't think it's going to help anything. But I think that's what we need to get to if we want to stop ransomware. Put the onus on the business owners where it's in their best interest financially to protect their company, protect their data, protect their people, protect their customers.
Yeah. I mean, there's got to be an initiative somewhere. It's not a bad idea.
No one else is going to do it. The insurance companies don't give a shit.
No, they're going to pop themselves.
Well, that too. But the insurance companies, they want you to self-attest so that they can come and say, too bad.
You said you did this stuff.
Exactly. I mean, I told you we have clients where we fill out the questionnaires for the insurance policies and we send them all the documentation backing up the answers to those questions. And they get so pissed off because we make it very clear. This is why I answered this question in this manner. If you have any questions, please let us know. If it's insufficient or doesn't answer the question, please let us know. So now we're putting that onus on them. They fucking hate it. But this goes back to my thing with making it punitive on the business owner. Put the onus on them to secure their house. And if they don't do it, tax the shit out of them. I think we're good at doing, not us, but government's good at that, right? Tax the shit out of them if they don't do what they say.
Yeah, they say that the U.S. has the most complex freaking tax laws known anywhere in the world.
If you understand them, it's probably a benefit to you. If you don't understand them, it's probably not. But at the same time, what I'd like to do, and if you're game for this, is create a little mini series around incident response, because I think you have a wealth of knowledge and experience that would help people. And furthermore, if you guys have an incident or you have something brewing, whether it's an insider threat, or you just want to test your systems, I highly recommend Eric over at Barricade Cyber, and it's barricadecyber.com. You can find him on LinkedIn at Ransomware, I think is your username on LinkedIn. Yep. Very original. I'm sure even the bad guys wish they got that one. And it's Barricade Cyber on Twitter. And I don't know. And how else do they get in touch with you when they need you?
Call 911 and say, I want directed to Eric. No, I'm just kidding.
We should get you a 911 email address.
Dude, that'd be awesome.
That would be, you know, that maybe that's our project for the next week. Get Eric a 911 email address that you guys can use if you are mid post or post incident, or hey, it's okay to test your systems and make sure you're doing it right. Mm-hmm. Eric doesn't want to take your IT guy's business. That's me. What Eric wants is to make sure you guys are secured, and he's more than happy to test it for a few Bitcoin here or there. Maybe less. It ain't free.
Bitcoin. All right, everybody. Thanks again for joining for another episode of Tip of the Spear.
Tip of the Spear.
As always, please subscribe to us on the podcast, AmplifiedAndIntensified.com. Subscribe to us here on YouTube if you like the video side, and give us a thumbs up. Give us a comment in, you know, your favorite social media of choice, and let us know how you like this show.
And tell us what you want to hear from us. Thanks again for joining us for the Cybersecurity Amplified and Intensified podcast.